Call this board session of Fluid Valley County Board of Supervisors to order. We'll begin with pledge allegiance followed by a moment of silence. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you very much. Mr. O'Brien, before we do anything else, we're going to...
Mr. Chair, I move Fluid Valley County Board of Supervisors and into a closed meeting pursuant to the provisions of Section 2.23711A6, the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended, for the purpose of discussing investment of funds.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Motion's been made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mr. Weaver. Ms. Seeger?
Aye.
Mr. Weaver?
Aye.
Mr. O'Brien?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Now in closed session. Mr. O'Brien?
Mr. Chair, I move the closed meeting be adjourned and the Savannah County Board of Supervisors convene again in open session. Be it resolved, the Board of Supervisors does hereby certify to the best of each member's knowledge, one, only public business matters lawfully exempted from open meeting requirements under Section 2.2-3711A of the Code of Virginia 1950 as amended, and two, only such public business matters as were identified in the motion by which the closed meeting was convened were heard, discussed, or considered in the meeting.
Do I have a second? Okay, we got a motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Ms. Booker. Ms. Eager? You're muted, ma'am. I read your lips, say aye. We're having an issue.
Aye.
There we go. Ms. Booker?
Aye.
Mr. Weaver? Mr. O'Brien?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. We're now back in open session. Next up will be the budget review for the agency presentations. 41, Fluid Valley SPCA, Caitlin Mancini.
Hi there, how is everybody?
Doing fine. How are you doing, dear?
Thank you. All right, Jerry Russell's supposed to be on here as well, but we were delayed. I know that she's on the phone, in the car, so give me...
I'm here. Go ahead.
Oh, hey, Jerry, good. Thank you.
Apologize for keeping you guys waiting. Mm-hmm. I got long-winded. I had a mail moment.
That's okay. We're glad to be here.
Oh, shit. Damn it.
Uh-oh. What are we doing? Sheet, give me a second here. Sorry. Right, so looking at the numbers from the budget of last year. Is that right, Jerry?
I should be. I can't see from a distance, but basically we met with the county and the numbers come out to just tad bit more than last year, so we've been keeping things down.
The last
keeping
year
things in line.
216,918, and same thing, like we were looking at projection, it's 236,855. So a lot of that, of course, goes to our full time and salary and wages. About 200,000 of that. And the rest is, of course, in our expenses of keeping the lights on and the heat on.
Spay and neutering.
Yeah, and the next biggest is going to be the spay and neutering from keeping these animals and keeping these numbers down in the county.
Sorry, board, about that. So up on the screen I have there, so the current year's budget for fiscal year 21 is $330,000. The baseline's 337. Baseline plus is if we paid 100% of everything, which we've agreed before that we have not with Ms. Russell previously. And we've gone through each column and said, because they are our public animal shelter, there are certain things that they do that we agree that whether we pay 75% or there are very a few small items that we pay 100%, and there's some that we pay 50%, and it just has to do with how it relates to what they do versus what what is required under the county's requirement for public animal shelter services. So my proposal was $338,000, and that was based upon their baseline times the 75%. And really, the only changes in some of that, there were some increases. If you remember previously with Mr. Nichols, there was discussions in the past to get the FSPCA and their employees on a level where they start having some increase in salary, because back 2-3 years ago, they were making $8 an hour and they couldn't keep anyone. And by us utilizing the FSPCA, that helps the county to not have to open up its own public animal shelter. So there was if you look at the pay plan here, there was a little bit of a plan to increase the salaries nominally every year. You know, back here in fiscal year 19, they were at $8 an hour. A plan was set to put them at 10, then 11, then 11.99, and 12.95. Most of their folks are not full-time. I think they've got, if I look here, I think they had maybe two people that are full-time employees, and a lot of them were part-time. So again, it was to keep continuity of our animal shelter. So that's really the biggest change in the budget.
Right. So where's the
pay now? Pay now, yes, let me go back. So right now, they are supposed to be at $11.99 per hour. Well,
yes, and we are.
Yeah. Yeah,
I was going to say, we're right there at $11.99 an hour, which we've done.
That's the lowest pay. And like I said, there are a few positions like some animal care leads and the shelter manager, you know, it's a little higher. But $11.99 was meant to be the minimum.
Right. And we've been able to keep good numbers with retention. Every now, you know, it's been pretty steady. We lose one person here and there, so it's been a big improvement as to for what it used to be.
That's good.
All righty. Are there any other questions? Y'all have anything else? Thank y'all for what you do. We do appreciate y'all.
Thank you very much, Ruth.
Thank you. We appreciate you.
Have a great evening.
Thank you too. Bye-bye.
Next is 68, Cooperative Extension, Ms. Mayo.
I'm not sure exactly where you need me to stand, but...
You can sit at the table there.
You have a seat right there. Just make sure you speak loudly with the mask so that we can record.
Sir, I will speak as loudly as I can in my good teacher voice.
And go.
The good news is we don't have much change at all in the extension budget this year. There's a nominal increase in the contract services line, and if you remember, that is the salary line that we are given from Virginia Tech. So it's not like I can say, let's give Kimeo a raise this year. They give us that contract service line, and that's what we pass on in there. The supply lines have not changed. We kept those the same from previous years. So.
And as Ms. Mayo said, her budget, you know, for the current fiscal year, the total is $104,453. It's a nominal increase of 100, going to $105,197. And as she said, it's just basically due to salary stuff.
Anyone have a question? Thank you so much for all that you do. Hopefully we can get you back to doing stuff this summer.
Amen to that. I'll just remind you, you are supporting, you know, agents in surrounding counties as well. So there's two FCS agents, four agriculture agents, a part-time 4-H person as well in this county. So that's where those contract services line goes.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it, ma'am. 61, library, Ms. Hoffman.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. My internet keeps popping in and out, so if you lose me, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, must live in Ken's store.
Okay, so Just a quick review over the last year. When the county closed, we closed to the public, and at one point, we were one of only five libraries in the entire state providing services beyond internet services. We started curbside in March, and we've continued it. We've opened by appointment for the computer room, and we've opened by appointment for browsing. And as long as the COVID positivity rates stay down, thankfully, we will continue all of those services. Internet use, the Wi-Fi has been very popular. We've served almost 8,000 people since March just using our Wi-Fi. We have also instituted summer grab-and-go craft bags. And right now they're monthly, but in the summer they're weekly. And we provide kits with science and craft activities for preschool, kid, teen, and adults. In fact, this summer we're going to do candy sushi and edible science experiments, and they're all very popular. We're even doing virtual story time where we reach at least 44 families with over 52 kids each week, twice a week. I can go to the next slide. Several years ago, we were in trouble with the state library for our per capita funding. And we are still ranked 80th out of the 96 libraries, but we have, we're at $15.53 per capita, and the state requirement is $11. So we're doing really well there. Next slide. Last year we brought in just over $5,000, which is probably half of what we usually bring in. But with COVID and quarantine rules, all items are quarantined. We stopped collecting fines, and we stopped charging for people to print out and do faxes, because a lot of it that we see coming in is so it's disability, it's veterans benefits, it's tax stuff, it's workman's comp, it's unemployment, and we just didn't feel like we should charge for those types of materials at this time with so many people out of work. In Eric's budget, there's an estimate for state aid, and since that time, they have actually increased our estimate for next year to $113,761, which I think is at least $6,000 more than what's in Eric's proposed budget. Next slide. So, including the state aid, the only thing that I would like to ask in addition to what Eric is recommending in the county budget is $3,939 to upgrade an existing position, which is a library assistant position, to a children's program specialist. This is the position that's doing our virtual story times. She is doing our Instagram, a lot of our Facebook posts. But any of the children's related materials, except for the grab and go kits, she's coordinating, and it would be a great upgrade for a nominal little bit. Any questions?
Any questions?
No.
All righty. Thank you so very much for your presentation. We do appreciate you, all you do.
And did the board want to see the actual worksheet itself, or? The budget sheet, okay.
I've got eagle eyes, I can see well.
There you go. You can see that 6 point. Good, thank you.
Don't let the lightning strike you too. Alrighty. Thank you so much, and now we'll move forward with 23, the registrar, Ms. Pace.
Good evening. Here with me, and we're double team, you guys. I can start. The news with our budget is that early voting was implemented right before the November election, and it's here to stay. And election law continues to change really rapidly and impact our budget needs. Savannah County voters really liked early voting, the changes we saw shifted how voters are casting their ballots in the county. In the 2016 presidential election, the central absentee precinct, which starts off in the registrar's office with early, it was with a reason, absentee voting by mail or with a reason in person, and is now no excuse. In 2016, we saw fewer than 2,000 votes cast in the cap. And last year, in November, we saw over 10,500. That makes up for more than two-thirds of the votes cast in the county came in through the registrar's office in the central absentee precinct, which makes for a lot of work in her office. This graphic, I want to be really clear, this is not mine, but I didn't want to just drop the link into a slide, so this is what's seen on this webpage from the Virginia Public Access Project. They got their data from the Department of Elections. I kind of just covered the broad strokes a second ago, that over 10,000 came in 2020. What I really want you to see is the bar graph in the bottom right. That, and the two colors, it's meant to show you how much is coming in by mail and how much is in person. But to me, the big takeaway is that over the 8-week period of early voting, which is going to happen now, that 45-day period is going to happen before every election, including primaries, the work is actually pretty steady. Like, yes, it dips down a little bit, but there's never a time, like, it didn't start off real low and work its way up. It's like, they're busy in that office.
Let me just remind everyone to just make sure when you're coming up here, because we're getting some feedback that we're not getting, that some people can't hear, and we're working on that issue for as far as better audio visual. But if it's like Ms. Mayo said, if you can use your school teacher voice, it's a little bit more difficult with the mask on.
Okay, I'll do my best. Y'all like give me a thumbs up if I need to.
Yeah.
Now the graph at the bottom, in person and mail. And that's not just Flu Vanna. What is that graph?
No, that is just Flu Vanna. That is
okay. Like, so it's more in person than mail. Okay.
Yes, it is more in person than by mail. We had what came back was just under 4,000 votes came back in by mail, but more go out than come back in. Mm-hmm. Although the law has changed so that the ballots can keep coming back in for a few days after the election. They can come in until Friday, and that was new in November. So more came back. It's also more work for the registrar's office. And processing mail ballots, another big change is that now voters have the option annually, if they voted absentee before, they now get a letter in the mail that says, would you like to vote absentee next year too? And if so, do you want to vote in a primary? Which sort of automates the process, which means that more ballots are likely to go out by mail and even for primaries, because people won't have to show up at the polls and they're just going to be checking a box.
Why is it even an option if they want to vote in a primary absentee? Why wouldn't you just mail them
out? No, well, that would be a waste to the county. But the voter, we would need to know which primary they want to vote in. So if it's a Republican primary, we wouldn't know that unless they check that on the application. So that's why, you know, we wouldn't send ballots every person.
It's like, the question is like general elections, primaries, if so, which one? And then it's automated, which means we're going to be printing more ballots, sending more out, assembling more in the office. But that graph, so that's showing the proportion by mail and in person, but that it's steady. Combined height of the, like there are some spikes, but it never really dipped down, except for on weekends when they were closed.
When you mail them out, do you check the signatures when they come back in?
No, we don't, we're not required. We don't have that kind of
difference. So if there's two or three people in a household, somebody could, in theory, someone else could vote.
They could.
Okay, that's what I was getting at.
Well,
you're not here.
Right, we don't have that qualification.
She's not a forensic expert to examine a signature. What they do know
is... Well, you can
is
tell pretty much the look of the person's signature.
They check to make sure
that forensic.
They've gotten a check. They check that before they mail a ballot out, that they have actually received an application to send that ballot out. They're not just sending out ballots that haven't been requested. And they're checking that that person's a registered voter in Flu Vanna County.
And you do accept them after the deadline, is that what you said?
Yeah, it's not a the deadline has been extended. The deadline used to be received in the registrar's office by election day.
It's 7 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. Now it is noon Friday following the election.
Why is that? Why?
If it's postmarked.
It has to be postmarked by election day, correct?
Okay. Yeah. So it is postmarked at this.
It's postmarked. Yeah, right. But if we cannot distinguish the date on the postmark, we still have to accept it.
That's all by code.
Well, you still have to accept that.
If we cannot determine the date by the post office.
The assumption is if it meets the deadline, which is now extended, then it was mailed by the time. If say, like if the postmark were blurred, we're not projecting it for that. But they're not just sending out absentee ballots, and we're not finding that a lot of people show up at the polls and say, and they're marked as having been. This is part of the work. When you vote absentee, you've applied, the ballot's mailed out. We've tracked that. When it comes back in, that's been tracked. Then on election day, we know whether or not we've received an absentee ballot by mail or an early vote in person. So when somebody comes to the poll on election day, we're not hearing hundreds and thousands of people have already voted, and they're like, no, I didn't. That's not a problem in Green County.
Yeah.
There's safeguards all along the way that don't include her being a forensic expert team.
She's not a forensic expert, huh?
No.
Okay, I got the message.
Okay. All right, next slide, please. This slide is to show that the popularity of early voting in Fluvanna is greater here than it is across the state and in our region. Joyce's office was fielding more early voters by mail and in person together per 1,000 registered voters than any of the surrounding counties and was one of the highest in the state. Our voters really like it. Next slide, please. Another big change is that voter registration keeps increasing. So that means she's taken care of more voters, more constituents. It's increased 18% since the 2016 presidential election. It's up to almost 20,000 voters. Next slide, please. So it is these types of changes that are impacting the labor demands in the registrar's office. It's like running a polling place for 45 days before every election. Each day it's like a brand new election happening in her office. And we got through it in November without a lot of complaints. The voters seemed really happy. The lines were manageable. Part of how we got through it is because we had a lot of volunteers. Next slide, please. This slide, Joyce can elaborate on this. This is just to kind of give y'all an overview of the steps that are involved and how this is increasing the demands in her office, but it's more complicated than voting on election day.
Yeah, and I don't want to go through each bullet, but you kind of get the idea. You're not just, when a voter comes in, you're having a lot of things happening at the same time. You've had someone outside wanting to vote in a car. You have curbside voters waiting. You have people that have questions outside, people that need that bring their absentee ballots and want to vote outside and then bring it in and put it in the drop box. So we're dealing with phone queries. It just, the magnitude is just enormous now with what we have to deal with, and having enough personnel to handle those situations is monumental for us. We see that we're making trips to the post office, and that can be several times a day because we're processing ballots, applications. We have to mail those ballots out. We are required by law to get those ballots out as soon as people request them. We cannot set on a request for a ballot. We have to process it within 3 days, or we will be in severe penalties of the law. We have to, there's someone having to assemble those ballots, stuff ballots, seal them, with the postage on. We're having to train staff on even COVID procedures. Several, as you can see, several requirements. We have to audit every night to make sure those ballots are tallied and reflect what we entered into the state's database, along with the electronic poll book, that everything matches. So a lot of things go on after we close at 5 o'clock. We're counting ballots from the drop boxes. We have to process those. you have now to do, we're required to do what's called pre-processing of ballots. So we collect a large number of ballots. We have to have a team of people that come in and pre-process, which is open those ballots, verify everything that would happen on election night, and then insert those ballots into a separate machine. So all of those things are going on at the same time as well.
That's a really transparent process where we're inviting representatives from both parties in. What she was describing there also gets to some of Mr. Weaver's concerns that we're keeping a multi-pronged system to ensure the integrity of the election, where there's the inputs into the voter registration system. That is a live change right then. We also keep an offline poll book that's created every day that's up to date with everything that happened the day before, so that we have a paper record of everybody who's voted then, and we also get signatures of everybody who's coming in early. So we have lots of safeguards that make it so that it's not just like showing up at the polling place on election day.
How's the new billing working now?
It's working very well. We don't have enough space already.
We still need some more. Hopefully we can get it in a year or so. Get a new billing. Another one.
That would be nice.
Is the registrar's office considered a precinct within the district, or is it its own precinct?
It is its own precinct.
It is. Okay.
Well, not in a district, say, for instance, at the Lake Monticello precinct. No.
No, so in other words, that would probably be Cunningham.
It's the central absentee precinct.
So it is.
Everybody who votes early and everybody who votes by mail, all of those get cast in the central absentee precinct.
So it is what we did on election night. The central absentee precinct was in the historic courthouse. They took everything that we did for the 45 days for absentee voting, and they handled it there. So it's its own precinct. So we have six precincts if you want to look at it that way. We have the five districts, and then the CAP is its own precinct.
The reason I ask is because I guess it's part of potential redistricting efforts. You know, were informed that, you know, basically if a boundary exists for, I guess it's a state legislator, that you need a precinct in each one of them.
Correct.
Which we don't technically follow right now.
Yes, we do.
I thought we were doing when we looked at the map, we weren't technically following that.
We are absolutely following. The law is that the voting location has to be within, I can't remember if it's a half mile or a mile.
I think it's a mile.
But all of our voting locations are actually located within the boundaries of their districts.
Okay. So then just with the potential of having those lines. With absentee balloting or early voting, I should say absentee, could the registrar's office come as a precinct?
No. No. It couldn't be her office and a polling location on election day.
Independent.
So there are some pending law changes where they might be asking Joyce to track, to split up from and count which voters from which precincts voted early. And those laws haven't passed yet. For right now, they're all reported en masse within the central absentee, which technically is at the old courthouse, but it will be seeing a request to relocate it to Joyce's new office.
That'll be coming forward sometime here shortly.
Yeah. The next slide covers some of the same type of topics of just extra steps and extra work, both in volume and meeting new law. That's kind of
clear.
You can go to the next.
Could I ask a question? This is Patricia Eager.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, how often do you purge the voter rolls and how do you do it?
Well, we get the information from the Department of Elections, and so yearly there's a purge. And monthly we get information, statistics, or static stats from the Department of Elections to remove any felons or anyone that has moved. That's daily. Anyone that moves or transfers to another locality, if that's done on a daily basis. But monthly, usually death notices, that type of information comes to us once a month, and then we purge from the information that the Department of Elections sends us.
Joyce calls it the hopper, Mrs. Eager, that in the hopper, the State Department of Elections will put a new list of voters for which an extra step has to be taken to either verify that they still should be registered or be removed. It's an ongoing,
but daily we are moving voters from locality to locality, transfers in, transfers out, people that move, we delete them from the rolls. That's a daily process.
You used to, because I've done it a couple of times years ago, call in people and we would sit around and go over the voter rolls and say, well, this person doesn't live there, doesn't live here anymore, this person died. Do you still do that?
No, we've never done that since I've been registrar.
Mrs. Eager, what they do is when certain kinds of mail is sent to voters and then it doesn't get responded to, that triggers an action in the registrar's office to change the status of that voter because it's a signal that they maybe don't live there any longer. And then that puts in process a whole system to verify whether or not they should be removed from the poll books. So there are all kinds of mail notices that are going out that require a response. Or
it's probably more than 20 years that that we would go over the voter rolls, yes, manually with just other people in the community, because I remember my daughter had left, finished college and was living somewhere else, and I said, well, she's not on or not in Pluvanna any longer, and they took her off. That's why I remember it.
DMV changes and all kinds of things make it so that that's a little bit more of an automated and ongoing process, and that's part of the work that's happening in the registrar's office every day, and even in the early voting period when voter registration is still active. Sometimes people wonder, well, why can't the registrar just take care of all the early voters? It's because she had a full-time job before, and she still does even during the early voting period, because they're making sure that the poll books are clean is one of the tasks.
The records are up to date.
And you, I think you just said we have 20,000 voters?
We're right at 20,000 voters, yes, ma'am.
And that's an 18% increase in 4 years.
And how many people voted in the last election in Pluvanna?
Yeah, it's around 16,000.
Yeah, almost 16,000.
It was about an 80% turnout. And that was a little higher than the state average, and that's normal for Pluvanna. We normally run 2 to 4 points above the state average for voter turnout. We like to vote early, apparently, and we like to vote.
And like we said, it was 10,529 voters did it through the early voting process.
Uh-huh.
So all of that work meant that the way we report sort of what you would think of as poll workers, it used to be on the budget as contract services. They now need to be part-time staff. And over that 8-week period, on average, Joyce's office is reporting just under 250 part-time temporary staff hours weekly. There was a peak of about 340 staff hours. Those hours do not include the assistant registrars, does not include their overtime either, and it doesn't include the 19 volunteers we had working there to get things done. We were absolutely dependent on volunteers in order to have survived that rush of work. So I hope what you're hearing is that this is sort of the big issue with our budget is labor and staff hours. Next slide, please. And the registrar's responsibilities have increased because of the law changes. She's now responsible for managing pre-processing, which is something that didn't exist. She has to manage risk-limiting audits, which we'll get to some of the concerns about how accurate. That's now mandated that after elections, we will be sampling ballots and hand-counting them, and that happens statewide, to verify that the results that happened in November actually match the audit. She's managing new drop box procedures. She's creating those procedures. She's supervising all these extra employees and volunteers. She's busy.
I know.
you have a question?
No, I was getting tired.
Oh gosh.
Past your bedtime, huh?
Coming up in this budget, we've got some lines where we're budgeting for additional mailings for redistricting. We're trying to show you that the law changes rapidly. It's continuing to change, and the General Assembly is often passing laws while we're in the budget period that we then have to be prepared to enforce without having had the chance to actually get it included in the budget. And we run a pretty lean budget, but we've been getting through it. There's also new mandated recertification of the voting equipment. This is all about making sure that it is secure, can't be hacked, encrypted, all of that kind of stuff. And that's tested on federal standards and state standards. And that makes it so that our equipment and our licenses for software, all of that gets more expensive because the vendors pass that stuff on down to us. And there are new enhancements to what we're required to do for physical security and cybersecurity. And that's also more labor for Joyce and sort of new skills that she has to learn. She's not trained as a cybersecurity specialist. We don't have anybody in the county trained that way.
Then we have to throw COVID-19 in the mix. So we have to have training for the staff to do that.
So that's what's happening in the office. The takeaway is that we need to have staffing levels aligned with the increased responsibilities and the increased volume. We'd like to reduce our dependence on volunteers because we can't guarantee that they're going to be there. They're showing up as volunteers to be good, out of civic duty, I guess. And that we need to be able to meet all the evolving demands, and we're asking for your support to help us succeed. Right now, Club Innovators seem really happy with the changes, and we want to keep everybody happy.
The only thing I'd say is we are very, very familiar with them changing the rules, because usually they change the rules and we end up paying for it.
Yes. There are a lot of increases. We're not talking about things that are optional. We're talking about mandates that have been passed down. And I have encouraged Mr. Dahl, whenever you all meet with our representatives in the General Assembly, to ask for the kind of support for their passing these changes. They have moved Virginia from one of the most difficult states to vote in to one of the easiest states to vote in. I think we're now top 11 as far as ease of voter experience. That's all really good news for voters, but they need to help the counties provide the funding to make it sustainable. And we're asking you, in the meanwhile, please help us sustain ourselves.
So the registrar's office, as you've seen in your budget document, has had a significant increase from the current fiscal year in 21 over to 22, and a lot of it has to do with those additional requirements for having more people, part-time people, in the office for early voting periods. If you think of one election, you have 45 days early voting. If you have two additional primaries, you have two additional 45-day early voting periods as well, which there's a minimum requirement to have so many people in the office at a time to do the voting responsibilities that have to take place. So me and Ms. Twisdale and Ms. Hobbs and Ms. Pace, we went through and really had to look hard at kind of some of the numbers and how those changes were coming about from contractual service workers to part-time. So this is the budget that I have proposed, and I think the biggest kind of just question mark are the primaries. If you have one less primary, you've got about 15,600 in part-time stuff, but then in addition, we've put the cost of some of these primaries in here for like the one-day election, and you're looking at around, it could be around $20,000 for a primary. So if you have one less primary a year, that could be around $30,000 to $35,000 that this budget would be less. But they're anticipating that there's going to be one election and then two primaries in the fiscal year 22 budget.
We were anticipating that when we put together the budget, because we thought we were going to get census data. Now, I don't know if that third primary will be a primary or a special election. All I can say is that I would be more comfortable keeping funding in there for a third election while we have a whole bunch of unknowns. It's not so much money that if we didn't spend it, it couldn't get carried into, you know, go back to the county. It's not. He's budgeted primaries for the small elections at, I think, $15,600. I would rather be prepared, especially because the cost for every type of elections, it's not equal. A November election is not the same as a special election. The turnout's not going to be the same. The volume's not going to be quite the same. Just since we started working on the budget, redistricting has changed. Mm-hmm. You all know that. We thought we were going to get data in April, and
just had a conversation about that last week.
So I did early voting at the registrar's office, lake there, and I want to say there were maybe 20, 25 people maybe in front of me, and it took about an hour and a half to get through that line. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, I know there were a lot of COVID protocols, I know there were a lot of check-in protocols and so on, but it seemed like a long wait for that number of people. And it's not a criticism. Don't hear me from that standpoint. I mean, it's just one of those things that we know was a big, a big election. And there were steady lines the whole time. I know you had volunteers and staff there. But I guess the question is, was there some lack of volunteers and staff that could have helped to make that process faster? Or is it just that's what it's going to be under COVID circumstances, and how would it be better?
Well, it's difficult to answer your question because I don't know what was happening at the time that you came. If we don't have enough personnel to handle people that are waiting outside, you have to stop. Someone has to go outside and assist. Like we had one day, we had five people in a vehicle that wanted to vote in one vehicle that needed to vote. Well, you have to take up enough time with each individual. So it's not stopping the line, the flow, because the person has to go in and interrupt. We have to go through the poll book. We have to go into the other run and enter them into the state's database. We have to get the ballot. We have to enter. All of the steps have to be handled with the individual outside just as well as the person inside.
By outside, she means curbside.
Sure. I understand that. I guess you have like an average expected metric per transaction or something like that.
I think that there are a lot of voters who saw a line that was 25 people deep and it probably took them under a half an hour. There were many other voters who, because somebody ahead of them in the line was non-standard, we don't call them difficult because they're just non-standard. Something's different with the registration and we have to verify and take extra steps. At a polling place on election day, that type of non-standard voter would get to go off to the side and work with the polling place chief, and the rest of the line could keep on flowing. Under COVID conditions and the registrar's office, the line kind of had to stop until that person's issue got resolved. Some of that is staffing and some of that was space, because we didn't have an extra chief type person that they could go over and have their extra attention and issues resolved, that we needed to bring Joyce in for each of those, or an assistant registrar for each of those, and there was only one space where that could happen. A lot of that's tying up the equipment so that they can't check other people in while they're resolving that issue. So it might have been, I don't know, might have been that when you early voted, you just had a little bad luck.
Whether it was an hour and a half or an hour, and that's why I asked if you have an average expected metric. Well, I get that there's always times when things get gummed up, but what would be your normal expectation for processing 25, 30 people? Is it a half an hour? Would be the normal, like about one person per minute or
less than that? With the extra steps, it might be one person per 3 minutes, one person per 5 minutes.
And then it depends on how long that person needs to stay in the booth.
Sure.
If we're only allowing three people in the booth at a time.
Yeah, that's why I ask. I mean, one person for every 3 minutes, that's 75 minutes right there.
Another thing with the November election, where we had those two constitutional amendments. So whether you were in line with people who were prepared and knew how they were going to vote on those constitutional amendments, or whether you were behind people who hadn't thought about it and had to read every word before, once they got in the polling place. All of those variables in the smaller space and with fewer booths to vote in, it can slow the process down dramatically.
Yeah, and Mr. O'Brien, I voted there too early, and honestly, when I went there, there was not one person in line. I went right up to the window, went through, and besides probably chit-chatting with someone for a little bit, I probably would have been in and out in 3 minutes easily.
Sure. No, I think it was really well done election. That's not a criticism at all. It's just do we need to do something more than that? That was really my question.
The more staff you want to fund, the better you want to do, the happier everyone will be.
Well, and my question, and I should have looked at this, but I thought about it after it came up. And this doesn't include the rent we pay for the building.
It does not. The rents, the 45, well, I don't remember, let's call it 45,000, is in the facilities.
It's not
included. It's not in this budget, no.
You all like election talk, don't you?
Well, you like those unfunded mandates. Yeah. We really appreciate those. It gives us a warm fuzzy.
Do you have any questions? And also, we have local elections this year.
Yeah.
It takes even more time.
Yeah.
And because you're meeting with candidates, it takes more time. Yeah.
If we can find the districts. You know?
Well, I mean, if we get the numbers and decide how many districts are going to be, you know.
So, it's not in our budget. I've heard that you'd like a kind of round number for how much it might cost to add a precinct. I'd say that the one-time fixed startup costs are under $20,000, between $15,000 and $20,000, and then ongoing will be about maybe $3,000 ongoing with officers of election. But to get one full set of equipment, it should come in under $20,000.
Same cost, district versus precinct.
Yes, and you can have, it's the same cost. That would be a polling place startup cost. And nothing in the law says you can only have one polling place per district. That's for you all to sort out.
Oh, so you can have two in some districts.
Well, I mean, that's up for you all to decide.
Polling place. There was some talk in this last election about drop boxes and so on, but then there was a concern about whether they were going to be manned or not manned, and preserving the integrity. Have there been any changes there? Would there be any expectation that would show back up again or not?
So they're now going to be mandated going forward. The minimum requirement is that we have one in the registrar's office. It can be more than that.
And I'm going to hate to say this, but I can see you putting one out against the door, putting one in Antioch, putting one in Fort Union. Somebody be mad and they're going back to four-wheel drive up. Change. Lock the drop box is going to be gone.
So there are security requirements.
You're thinking ahead, huh?
Yes. The electoral board discussed it, and there are certainly security requirements, and the new law will require certain levels of security protocols too. You certainly don't want to have that not videotaped, and it needs to be secure and fixed.
Right? And every one of those things comes with a price tag.
Yeah. And right now, we feel the safest and most cost-efficient is in the registrar's office.
Yeah. Or inside the precinct on election day. That's what we did this past election.
So that way, if you got your mail ballot and you didn't get it to the post office in time, you could take it to the polling place and drop it in.
The security protocols were put in place. They all worked out fine.
I think we're still waiting on some of it, but yeah, things are getting better.
Well, thank y'all so much for everything y'all do. I'm going to tell y'all.
Wow, you did a great job.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Trying to keep up with the changing rotation of laws and cycles.
It takes you like.
Do you have an assistant? Do you have someone working with you in case you had to leave? Or do you have someone that you're training?
Well,
maybe
I should take the
You know, well, the assistant registrar I think that the last election was I don't want to do this anymore.
Okay.
It was too overwhelming.
All right.
And I had staff to get sick. Just by the grace of God that I didn't end up in the hospital, but I had staff member in the hospital and one that had to take off because it was
That was work exhaustion. So she's lost one assistant registrar because of the workload in November. prior to that, another assistant registrar, I think we brought, this happens in the county, left after Joyce Traynor to go work in Henrico, I believe. And then there's the part-time assistant registrar who's very skilled and who can definitely help if Joyce is not able to be present. But she's part-time.
Okay. Oh, I see.
Yeah,
that
sounds really. And really, that is temporary part-time. Just not. She should be
permanent
part-time. I think that's changed. Yeah. All right. All right. Thank y'all so much. Yes. Tell my girls to
tell
them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. Thank you.
All righty. Next up is 57, Social Services, Ms. Maeve.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the board.
Good evening.
I am so happy to be here.
Just let me know when you want me to go to the next slides.
Okay. Yeah, this is the first time I've been here in almost a year.
Lucky you.
Me too. I bought one of those cardboard cutouts.
So we submitted our budget request back in November, and then we met with Mr. Dahl and the finance staff in December and went over our budget request. And so we tweaked a few of the budget lines just to make them more accurately reflect actual spending and what we actually needed. So we are in agreement with the county administrator's recommendation for our budget. However, a couple of things have come up since we submitted our budget request, which is what I'd like to talk about tonight. So there's three things that I'm going to hit on. And so the first is the acceptance of state-approved salary increases and bonuses to address our compression, approval of a new position that is state-funded, and then I wanted to address our CIP request as well. So you can go to the next slide, please. So last year, there was legislation in the General Assembly to increase minimum pay bands for social services employees by 20% for family services positions and 15% for all of the other positions, and then a pay increase to address the compression that would cause. And it was approved, but then it ended up getting unallotted. So it's back before the General Assembly this year. And so just a little bit of background. The state's minimum pay bands haven't been increased in years. They are really low. The General Assembly is finally taking a look at that and are realizing that they need to significantly increase our minimum pay bands. And just as an example, I started out as a social worker with social services 27 years ago. And 27 years ago, the starting salary for a social worker, the state's minimum, was $20,000. 27 years later, the state's minimum salary for a social worker is $30,000 a year. And this is a position that requires a 4-year degree minimum. It's a very difficult job, requires extensive training. So so this year, the General Assembly is looking at increasing our minimum pay bands. And they're also looking at giving a salary increase for state-supported local employees to address the compression that's going to cause. Because when they move the minimum pay bands up that much, it's going to move new people up to making what people are making that's been around for a while. So the House is recommending a 3.5% salary increase and a 1.5% one-time bonus in September. And you can go to the next slide. And then the Senate is recommending the same thing, just a 3% salary increase instead of a 3.5%. And the next slide. And this is just some of the reasons why the General Assembly is looking at increasing minimum pay bands. And it's just because our salaries significantly lag behind comparable state positions and the amount of turnover statewide. You know, the turnover is 35% for family services specialist one positions. Next slide. So how is all of this going to affect us? So the increase in minimum pay bands will definitely create compression for existing employees in our office. So any salary increase, bonuses approved by the state will be needed to address this compression. And you may remember, but 2 years ago, we did an alignment study. And the county helped fund that, and what happened, it brought up all of our employees, except for three, up to where they should be. However, the alignment study, the way it's conducted is there's an Excel spreadsheet. It assigns every employee an experience ratio depending on their experience. The experience ratio is applied towards the pay band, and that's how it determines the salary. So with the pay bands coming up that significantly, after July 1st, if we were to do another alignment study, it's going to show that all of our staff are probably about 15% under where they should be. And also right now, so our minimum pay bands are just a little bit higher than the state's. There's most of the localities that use the state minimums are counties in Southwest Virginia. The only two localities around here that I know that pay state minimums is Buckingham and Cumberland. So 34% of our employees come from Cumberland and Buckingham, because that's the only localities that we pay more than they do. Only 40% of our employees actually live in Fluvanna, and that's because for the biggest part of the population, you can drive to Charlottesville and Albemarle Social Services in 20 minutes and make $10,000 more a year, or you can drive 20 minutes to our office and make $10,000 less a year. So when the pay band increases are approved, then we will be at the new state minimum, which means we will be among the lowest paid social service agencies in the state. And this is going to make it considerably more difficult for us to recruit and retain employees. Next slide, please. And so this is just looking at the pay increases. So Mr. Dahl had recommended a 2% pay increase for all county employees, and for our office it would cost $30,895. The estimated state federal match to that would be $26,000. So, and I know in the past the county has not wanted us to receive the full state pay increase because it was more than what the county gave other county employees. So I just wanted to point out that if we took a 2% in lieu of 3%, we would be turning down $13,000 in state and federal dollars. If we gave a 2% in lieu of a 3.5%, we would be turning down almost $20,000 in state and federal funds. And if we turn down the 1.5% salary bonus, we would be turning down $20,000 in state and federal dollars that would be come to our employees and back to the county. And actually, it will be more than the $20,000 because that figure is based on current salaries. And if there's a salary increase July 1st, then that figure would actually be more. Next slide, please. So this is just to kind of show you what our salary ranges are. These positions, this is the positions in our administrative unit. The blue is what our current minimum pay bands are. And the red is the current state minimum pay bands. So you can see we are just very slightly above the state minimum. The green is what the new state minimum will be. So if that passes, then we will be up to where the green is.
What are the other categories under the bottom? I can't read
it. Oh, that's the different positions. Fiscal assistant 3, secretary 2.
Okay.
That's our positions in our administrative unit.
What's the last one?
The last one is the director.
The director. Okay.
And you can go to the
next slide,
please. And this is the same. This is our benefit positions. Mm-hmm. And you can see the blue is just slightly higher than the red. So we're very slightly higher than the state's minimums. But when the state minimums go up, we'll be up to the green. And then the next slide, please. And this is our family services positions. And you can see that the blue, we're actually quite a bit higher than the state minimums, but when they go up, you'll see the green, we will go up to what the state's minimum is. The additional position, the state is making some programmatic changes to CPS ongoing and foster care prevention, and doing so, and based on our caseloads, they are recommending that we add another CPS position. And we received a letter that we're getting a permanent allocation of $58,000 to hire a new family services specialist for fiscal year 22. It's 100% state funded, but then beginning in fiscal year 23, it will require 15.5% local match or $9,000. And so we would like to ask for approval of a new position.
And Ms. May, that just came out with kind of what's being proposed, or is that definitive?
That's definitive. That's something separate from the General Assembly.
It's a zero impact on the budget.
I know the first year does. I was just curious if that was tied into what is potentially going to happen.
It's okay. Not. Okay. Yeah, this is already a done deal.
Okay.
So, and then I just wanted to talk for a minute about our CIP. I know that the county administrator has it in his proposed budget for our vehicle replacement. And so I just wanted to say that we have not always provided safe and reliable vehicles for our staff. A few years ago, we were allowed to start including vehicle replacements in the CIP, and so we finally got to a place where we were able to provide safe and reliable vehicles to our staff. And it's really important considering the nature of the work that they do. Last year, we did not request a vehicle replacement in the CIP, and so we're kind of a year behind now in our replacement plan. And I would hate to go 2 years without a vehicle and get behind in our replacement plan and be in a bad situation again. And then also I wanted to talk about the $640,000 that's in the proposed CIP for the new admin social services building design work. And I know that we've talked about this before, but sort of just as a reminder that for a new social services building, we would be able to bring down some state and federal funding to go towards that. Our regional finance manager has offered to come out and meet with me and Ms. Twisdale and Mr. Dahl to talk about how that would work. My understanding of how that would work is that any kind of debt payments could be run through our budget, and we could draw down at least a third federal funding to go towards that.
That's not calculated, huh?
No, it's no. not.
That's great.
Yeah.
Mr. Weaver, kind of better on
that. And like I said, Ms. May, Ms. May
starts off a sitting here someplace. I think that's very important.
Ms. May, you know, brought that up, and you know, we have to sit down and meet with the state finance director to kind of talk about the details of that. If that's the direction the board wants to, if that's the direction we move forward with.
And so with that, the reason for the recommendation for a new building is our current building, it does not meet our needs for IT security, physical security, or physical space. So with IT security, we have access to IRS information. And because of that, we have very strict guidelines that we have to follow in protecting IRS information. And so the state comes in and they tour our building to make sure that we are following IRS regulations, and currently we are not. And the biggest barrier that we are not following IRS regulations is that some of the space in our building we actually share with performing arts, and then there's other space in the building where there's not actually a physical barrier between the performing arts space and our space. So that has been addressed. As far as physical security, I will say I love our building. I really do. But it was built to be a high school in 1934 and not so much to house social services in 2021. And so physically, it's not secure. We've done a lot to try to make it more secure. But a lot of social service agencies are located in or close to their sheriff's office. If we were to have an active shooter incident in our building, it would be over before the sheriff's office could respond.
It's and not only that, it's just an odd combination with having, as Ms. Babe said, the Arts Council and DSS there. It just, again, that's where we try and get like functions in the same space.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then with the physical space too, we're already outgrowing it, and it is a very large space, but the way that it's cut up is not efficient. And so when Mr. Bowers was here and did the space study, he did a couple of different options. One was for a new space, new building for us, and the other was to renovate our current space. But the estimate to renovate our current space was at $2 million. And Mr. Nichols had mentioned that for $2 million, you could about put up a new metal building for us. So do you really want to invest $2 million in a building and it's still going to be an old building? You know, that's just a question to ask. But moving on to the next slide, I'm very excited to talk to you about what we've been up to the last year. So we've got our numbers for fiscal year 20, and just to let you know that in fiscal year 20, 5,200 residents of Luvanna County received SNAP, TANF, or Medicaid benefits through our office. And that's 20% of the population in Luvanna. Next slide, please. And this is some of our services numbers. The foster care, not all of our numbers are counted there because this report doesn't count the number of kids we have in foster and futures. But we currently have 20 children in foster care. During fiscal year 20, 390 children were the subject of a CPS referral. 139 adults were the subject of an adult protective services referral.
How many of those referrals went on after that?
They resulted in investigations or family assessments. So we had to respond to those reports. And this is just our spending from fiscal year 20. So in fiscal year 20, $37,580,000 was spent on Fluvanna Social Services. Of the $37 million, $1 million, $1.3 million was local funds. The other $36 million was state and federal funds, and that includes administration and benefits that are paid out to the residents of this county that come back to this, the local economy. And so, and a little more about what we've been doing over the last year. Actually, since COVID, our caseloads and workloads have significantly increased because people have been out of work. With some months, the number of SNAP and Medicaid applications we've received have doubled or tripled. We were fortunate enough to get some additional state funds this year to pay for overtime because our staff is having to work overtime to get the work done. When COVID first came, we were told we would not have to do annual redeterminations for benefits, just focus on getting all of the new applications processed. Now they're telling us we have to go back and do all of the redeterminations that we didn't do. And so they did give us a little extra for overtime to address that. So our workers are working overtime to try to keep up with that workload. And the state, because of COVID, there's been some new programs. There's been SNAP emergency allotments. There was the pandemic EBT program. There's COVID fuel assistance. There's been lots of policy changes that we've had to navigate. So there's been a lot going on the benefits end. As far as services goes, our social workers have worked really hard since COVID. Through the pandemic, we've still been required to meet all of our mandates for face-to-face contacts, our home visits, we've transported clients, we've had to place children in foster care. We meet with recipients to issue their EBT cards. It's very unnerving for a worker to learn that a home they visited last week now is tested positive for COVID. Yeah. And not only are they worried about themselves, mm-hmm. but they're trying to figure out, okay, how many other homes have I been to since I was at that home?
Yeah.
And a lot of agencies during COVID were not having face-to-face contact with clients. And because of that, we picked up extra work. For example, we had to start doing our own forensic interviews again in Child Protective Services investigations, and our staff, they are trained to do forensic interviews. We have helped out with the Sheriff's Office and done some forensic interviews for them as well, just because some of the other agencies are not having face-to-face contact with clients and recipients, and we have not had that luxury. And I will say that our staff have been troopers. They've been excellent. They haven't complained. They come to work every day just wanting to help people, and they put themselves at risk every day. And so just in summary, with all that said, these are the three things that I'm asking for. I'm asking that if the state approves salary increases for our staff or bonuses, to please allow us to accept those state funds and give those pay increases and bonuses. Our staff have worked really hard And with the new pay band minimums, that's gonna create compression and put all of our staff under where they should be as far as pay-wise. And then to please approve our new position that's being state funded, and to also grant our CIP request. And thank you very much for your time. And I think there's one more slide.
Oh, sorry. There you
go. One of many people that's asking for something.
And if you remember from my proposed budget on Ms. Mabe, she had a pretty big increase in her budget, but a lot of it was for more programmatic stuff, and it was primarily mainly covered from state and federal funds. So although her budget overall dollars increased, it was covered by state and federal funds primarily.
But that extra position and
was not in there.
So what's a net impact of? That's not even in her baseline.
No, it's not. I mean, so I think it was, what's it, 58,000 or so? Is that something what you have for the position?
Yeah,
I mean,
we didn't learn about that until after we submitted the budget request.
The position, there's no cost.
That's passed through.
The salary stuff's not included, and that's one thing. There's so many things happen between the House and Senate bills for whether it's social services, whether it's constitutional officers, there's, sheriff's office, there's lots of different variations, and until we kind of get some clear guidance on what's going to come out. But the one thing we have heard, though, is we have heard at least 3% on a lot of things.
Three
in this
three
way,
and a half for the most part.
Yeah.
Across the board.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sort of from a categorical position, if you looked at deputies, teachers, social services, Where is sort of the base salary level in those positions, notwithstanding competitiveness in the area for social services? Or do we have any analysis on that? Because I think it's a fair point to say, I can teach here, or I can, do social services here, or I can be a deputy here. We understand that there's always, we can't compete with every locality, but in theory, we want to be at least at a baseline for all those positions.
Yeah, we have. I mean, we
so far out of whack.
Yeah.
Have a human resources comp study thing.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't. I mean, the county hasn't done a comp study in quite some time, and it costs money to do that. Every year, HR would try and go through and kind of do some comparative reviews of our neighbors, and just like the schools provided. This is where their teachers stand ranked with everyone else. I don't know if we have something like that from social services. But to answer your question, no, we don't have that information where we kind of stand on all of our positions, throughout our neighbors and stuff.
Yeah, Ms. Mabe sort of argues for the fact that, well, yes, we have tried, and I think fairly so in many cases, to apply the same salary increases across the board. But what I'm driving at is if, in fact, their positions are, sort of categorically speaking, below where the rest are, and we're really not addressing the compression issue, are we being short-sighted in that?
Well, I think you could probably look across countywide that, certainly, I'll talk to use finance, for example. Folks in the finance department, you could go to Charlottesville or Albemarle and make more money,
I think this point is how much is the difference? Are we way farther behind in social services than we are the teacher?
Right.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
I mean, I think he wants to do a comparison of what's the split. If the split is bigger, we may want to.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, and like I said, we could pick some positions and do some, some sampling to see what it looks like.
Oh, sort of jumped out to me looking at the
but
sort of base salary, $30,000. I mean, yeah,
I don't know if you can compare all the social service purpose with all teachers.
Well, no. We're not comparing them to, we're doing apples and apples.
Yeah,
take a teacher in Charlottesville and a teacher in Bluvanna, then take a social worker one in Charlottesville and social, what's the percent difference?
Yeah.
Is it 10% greater to teach in Charlottesville
is there
25% greater to be social services?
Yeah, is there a kind of a metrics? Are all positions across the board, you know, 10% below?
I think so.
25% or whatever.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Study,
yeah.
The state do a study for and show where you place among other social services. And let me ask you about, say, for example, if the 3.5 or the 3% or the 1.5, if it does not occur and it does not pass, what will happen to your and other areas, social service areas, except that 3.5 or 1.5? What will that do to your staff?
Right, so our staff, they work very closely with other local departments of social services, and if the state gives that increase, I've never heard of another local social services, their locality not letting them take the funds, and so for our staff, it does hurt morale when they see that the other local departments of social services are getting that increase and they're not.
And would that say Buckingham people who come over here, if Buckingham get in the rate, would those Buckingham people go back home?
Well, when the minimum salaries go up, we'll be paying the same that Buckingham and Cumberland will be. Right now we pay more than they do, which is why 35% of our employees live in Buckingham and Cumberland, because right now we do pay more than they do.
When they're at the new minimum,
we'll no longer pay more than they do. But there'll be a lot of agencies that pay more than us.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be at the bottom of the state when that happens.
Yeah. Kim's right. I'm on the Social Services Board. Those people work very hard for very little money, and I wouldn't like like for us to pass up the money that's given to them by the state and the federal government. You know, that's tax dollars too. But like what Kim is saying is, if other counties take it and we don't, our people suffer, and they work really hard.
I agree.
What has been the? I know a couple of years back the turnover ratio was really high in social services. Has that sort of ameliorated a little bit, or is it still?
We still do have a lot of turnover. It's not as high as it once was. I think the alignment that we did a couple of years ago helped.
How about this question? Is most of your turnover now because of burnout from the job or because they find more money somewhere else?
A little bit of both.
So it's probably about 50%, I mean?
Yeah.
Very similar to teachers.
And for example, right now, we have been trying for months to fill our front desk position, but our minimum salary is $25,000, and we can't hire anyone. And we've been months now without someone to answer our phones, and we receive about 1,500 phone calls a month. So we've advertised two or three times, and so finally with our last posting, we just had to leave it open until filled. And we're still trying to fill that position. I've had people in the county that were interested and called me and just said that's just not enough money.
All right. Thank you so very much. We do appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
You're awesome. Good job. Okay.
36, Fire and Rescue Association, Mr. Lye.
Good evening. Sorry it's so late.
We're part of that problem.
I'll try and go through this, but please stop me if I go too fast with questions. I'd rather this be a dialogue than a monologue.
Just let me know when you want me to go.
Go to the next phase. So I just start by mentioning what our mission is. And so the Fire Rescue Association, in conjunction with the Emergency Management Coordinator, is designed to ensure that fire and emergency medical services are provided in the most effective and efficient manner possible. And so that is, part of that is coordinating the budget so we're not getting peaks and valleys in the budget process. And this is actually directly from the county website. It consists of members of Lake Monticello Fire, Lake Monticello Rescue, Lake Monticello Water Rescue, Flavanna Fire, and Flavanna Rescue Squad. So it's an umbrella organization. So if we go, next slide please. So just a little bit of organization. So Havana County Fire and Lake Monticello Fire, although they are separate agencies, they work together so seamlessly that I just put it here as they volunteer staff four stations and respond to incidents throughout the county. They work together very, very well. Lake Monticello Volunteer Rescue is still 100% volunteer and responds to incidents in the in their first due area, which is, to a first approximation, the northwest quadrant in the county, and throughout the county as needed. Havana County Rescue is supplemented by paid staff who run the bulk of the calls, and they respond to incidents in that other three quadrants of the county, and again, throughout the county as needed. And that sounds grossly unfair on the surface, but in fact, if you look at population and call volumes, that's actually about a 50-50 split. And then the water rescue team responds to incidents throughout the county and provides mutual aid to the surrounding jurisdictions when requested. Next slide, please. So I'll start with a few statistics, and I'm going to break them down both by category and by apparatus. Next slide, please. So we'll start with Company 1, which is Palmyra for the fire department. And this is just by the various categories of fires. So this is for fiscal year 20. So there were 24 structure and chimney fires. There were 40 brush fires. You can go through it and see it. A lot of smoke activations, motor vehicle crashes, gas leaks, weather-related, public assistance, mutual aid, and EMS calls. Go to the next slide, please. Similar breakdown for Lake Monticello fire. Again, very similar in terms of structure fires and brush fires. There were 16 vehicle fires. A variety of other responses, hazmat responses, and there are a lot of EMS responses in there. The Lake Monticello Fire Department is very good at coming out and giving lake rescue assistance. Next slide, please. And then this is basically breaking the responses out by apparatus to show that the vehicles really do go out, because there was some question about how the apparatus were being used. So if you look at the two engines, they're roughly similar in 113 versus 124 calls. Tanker went out 44 times, squad 10 57, brush 10 118, car 10 116, car 11 23. So that's how it's broken out for Company 1. If you look at Company 2, engine 20, if you recall, had a catastrophic failure and was placed on a service early in fiscal year 20, so it only had 10 calls, whereas engine 21 had 175 calls. Tanker 20 went out 28 times. Attack 20 went out 97 times. Car 20 went out 110 times. And car 21, 154 times. Similarly for Lake Monticello, you can see the responses. The two engines went out. Engine 52 was out of service for a fairly extended period of time, so its numbers are down a bit. The tower ladder went out 129 times. Tanker 54 went out 49 times. Squad 51, which is often used for EMS responses, went out 234 times. Brush 50 went out 60 times. Car 50, 372. Support 57, 40. The POV to the scene is fire calls only. We do not allow members to respond POV to EMS calls. And then the standing by in quarters, with the COVID-19 protocols in place, typically we have firefighters stand in quarters unless they're actually needed on scene, but they're ready and available when needed. Next slide, please. So I'll move to the rescue squad at this point. Lake Monticello Rescue ran 1,427 of the 2,853 total EMS calls countywide. So as I mentioned earlier, that's pretty close to 50%, even though geographic-wise it's a smaller first due. And they ran 545 calls as billable BOS calls, 154 calls as billable ALS calls, and 7 as billable ALS2 calls. And this is directly from ImageTrend. And then, interestingly, 721 calls were public assist, lift assist, or refusals. With the aging population in the county, we get an awful lot of lift assists these days. We're getting a lot of them. But we also take refusals on occasion, sometimes against medical advice. But, you know, we can't force somebody to go to the hospital if they don't want to go. Next slide.
What is ALS?
So BLS is basic life support. So that's, I'm an EMTB, so that if I'm the ASE on the call, it's a BLS call. It's basic first aid and transport, stabilization. So AOS is when you have interventions like drugs and IV access, things like that.
Oh, what is it? Two, not AOS, two.
So that's a higher level.
Higher level.
Yes, ma'am.
And
obviously we don't do too many of those.
Like the contract crew, they're AOS.
They are AOS crews, but they don't always transport AOS.
Yes.
So a lot of their calls are still billed as BLS calls. So if they don't do any interventions, it's a BLS call. Okay, any other questions on that? Okay, so one of the biggest costs in our operating budgets are vehicle maintenance, and I'll provide some examples of these if we go to the next slide. So this is, and the numbers are coming here from Lake Monticello Fire because that's, for me, is the easiest to get good numbers at. So as you can see, engine 52 was fairly expensive. Engine 51 is about $5,000, whereas engine 52 is $12,000. As I mentioned, it was out of service for a little while for repairs. Tanker 54, you can go down the list. So the total, and this is just for fiscal year 20, single year, was almost $55,000 just in vehicle maintenance costs. If you can go to the next slide, it's a similar breakdown for Lake Monticello Rescue Squad. And you'll notice that ambulance 54 there doesn't have a lot of maintenance. That's the one that was totaled partway through the year, so if obviously we didn't do any maintenance on it after that. We are in the process of still replacing that now. But again, the total for vehicle maintenance for the rescue squad in 1 year was almost $36,000 just in vehicle maintenance. So it's a huge part of our budget. They're expensive. Next slide, please. So, as we've discussed here previously, we do have a replacement schedule to try and keep those maintenance costs down. So the major fire apparatus, the engines, the tankers, and so forth, they're on a 20-year cycle for NFPA standards. We are talking about some of the lighter apparatus going to a 10-year cycle, although that is still proposed at this point that we haven't actually implemented that yet. And then the ambulances are on an 8-year cycle just because they go out so much more often and get so much more use. And next slide, please. So some of the statistical information from Lake Fire. So, and this is getting into what the volunteers are contributing to the county. So these are all volunteers, unpaid, providing the services to the county residents. So on fire incidents, typically the average response is 10 members. EMS incidents has been about 5 members. So in 1 year, fiscal year 20, there were over 1,000 hours of training hours. And then VDFP classes, another 1,300 hours. Extrication training, another almost 200. And duty crew trainings was 25,000 man hours of training. And that's actually less than normal because of COVID restrictions this year. Normally that would be higher, but I'm giving you the most recent numbers. That's just training hours, not including the times actually running calls. Next slide, please. And then this is some of the requirements for EMS training. So an EMTB now is 150 hours of classroom plus clinical time. If you go to now they're an AEMT. It's another 350 hours on top of that. And for a paramedic, it's in the range of 1,200 to 1,800 hours, depending on which program. So it's a 2-year program plus prerequisites. So it's there's a lot of training involved just to get to be able to volunteer your time. But then in addition to that, all these people have to do ongoing continuing ed to keep their certification. So I'm a state EMTB, and I have to have 40 hours of continuing ed within 4 years. If I was national registry, it'd be those same 40 hours within 2 years, every 2 years. The advanced EMT is 50 hours, and the intermediates is 55 hours, and a nationally registered paramedic has to do 60 hours of CE training every 2 years. So in addition to running calls, there's this ongoing continuing education as well. And if we go to the next slide, please. So I'll stop there unless there are questions. There is some supplemental information if you want to get into cumulative statistics and so forth, but given the time of day, I'll leave it at that unless there are questions. in. So this is some of the cumulative maintenance costs for Chief Constantino. Since 2014, Lake has spent almost $330,000 on maintenance on all the apparatus over the last, whatever that is, 7 years. And then he also has some statistics on membership and other activities that have been going on. The most important one is the one at the bottom, I think, to me anyway, which is maintaining that Class 5 ISO rating, which is really helpful for keeping residents' fire protection insurance, homeowners' insurance costs down. And that is strictly due to the support that you guys have given us over the years and being able to support the fire services. So I thank you for that.
Question about Ladder 53, I guess. That's a vehicle that we bought a couple of years ago, isn't it?
That
truck was purchased in the latter part of
1993. Relatively low mileage. Why is the maintenance on that, both maintenance and repair costs, so high?
Because as a specialty piece, it's not like a regular engine. The tower ladder with a lot more functional parts. It's 28 years old, so everything's fatiguing, including me. And it costs a lot to maintain it. I mean, it's been out of service for a better part of this month and a little bit of last month. It's not due back to come in service until the middle of March, because it's experiencing right now transmission problems. And they just received the parts to fix it today, and they're estimating it will be repaired and getting preventive maintenance, and be back in service in the middle of March. And we've been going back and forth with Atlantic to repair it sooner because we need that truck.
Throwing
ladder truck in the town.
Sort of surprising you because it's essentially a big truck engine, right?
Yep.
And those truck engines usually go hundreds of thousands, if not millions of miles.
You can't look at the mileage, you have to look at the hours.
Uh-huh.
The truck, mileage-wise, at least where it came from, was not a large response area like Flavanna, but it did 2,000 calls a year and had a lot of engine time, a lot of pump time, and that's basically the problem. You can't base it for truck's durability as far as mileage is concerned, how long the pump and the engine has run, the ladder has run, and that's what figures into the maintenance cost so much. And being a specialty truck as it is, it costs a lot for parts. And being that age, the truck also, it's hard to find parts.
But you
waited a month to get a gasket for the transmission, for a transmission retarder.
The other night we had an EMS call, and I sat in engine 31 for an hour and 15 minutes. And just, it idles the whole time. You just sit there. Engine 7 from Louisa was the same thing. And one of the squads from the lake, they had to sit for an hour going to that.
But you're exactly right. It was bought as a used vehicle, as a stopgap until we could get a full replacement. And it is on the schedule to be replaced in a couple of years. And it's going to be a big price tag. But it was bought as a stopgap to get us through because the previous tower ladder had pretty much reached the end of its life.
The ladder that you were showcasing was, I forget the price tag, but it was...
Was that one that, that was in the area of $1.5 million. But again, the longer we wait, the more cost it's going to be, because historically, with all fire apparatus, you're looking between a 3% and 5% increase every year. Just for the just doing business, you get an increase every year. So,
do we have a maintenance person on staff that looks after the maintenance people come to Flavanna? Do you have to transport the vehicle somewhere?
So we have talked about getting a possible maintenance person countywide to look at the fire apparatus. There are some issues with how to work that out, but it is something we've talked about. There are services that will come out and do the maintenance on site. Some of the others have to be taken in to town to be serviced.
But once again, you go back to that thing, such specialty. You don't want somebody messing with it, doesn't know what you're doing there.
Right.
And fire trucks, anything you do, what's the average oil change for a fire truck? It's $45 for your car, probably. How much is it, Chief?
My just PM on my engines, the preventive maintenance that I do once a year, it's in the area of $2,500 to $2,800. And I do the tower ladder twice a year because it's so old. So I don't want an engine to blow or a transmission to blow. That costs me, costs the county, in the area over $3,000 for each PM. And we faithfully do our PMs, as all the other companies do, at least once a year.
Just
try to hold down these costs.
I'm just going to leave a text message from our lieutenant for all the things that have to be done to different apparatus in our building. It's just the price of doing business.
And it's not a standard diesel mechanic. It's got to be somebody that's certified to work on emergency vehicles.
Yeah, it's got to be an emergency vehicle technician certified. God forbid something happens, you open yourself to the Lord's feet.
Or take the mortgages out of church.
Let's see here.
So
for their budget.
Zero, dang, go. Hell yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Keep one, you all know that much.
So the current fiscal year 21. The current fiscal year 21 budget's $1,032,000. They requested for a baseline plus of $1,232,000. My budget includes $1,074,000. In this budget, we have some of the insurance costs in here, vehicle insurance that we pay for all of them, general liability, workers' comp, things like that. Really, the big item that fluctuates generally is from the operational cost. In the current budget, we funded Lake Monticello a little over $301,000. A little over $301,000 for Fluvanna Fire, $173,000, which is divided up by the three companies. Fluvanna Rescue, $100,000. And there's some smaller amounts. In what was requested for the baseline plus, there was requested increases that ranged from 17% up to, I don't remember what the high mark was, but maybe 25% in that range. I didn't fund the baseline plus. I funded a 10% increase across the board from the current fiscal year 21 budget. And the budget also includes state fire funds, 4-for-life funds, and some other things as well.
So I guess it begs the question, if we've got 10% increase, which seems like a pretty good increase, and requests coming in as high as 25%, what's not being met?
So what I do want to point out is that 25%, you're not comparing apples to apples here. That 25% increase is compared to last year's funded request. If you look at last year's request compared to this year's request, it's more like 6 to 8% overall. So, but the county budget last year only funded 90% of last year's request. Does that make sense?
You're talking specifically Lake Monticello.
Specifically Lake Monticello.
And again, we don't own the apparatus, we don't own the buildings, and so.
But this is operational budget. So,
not necessarily.
But the point is, it was if you compare request to request, the number isn't as high. If you compare funded to request, is where you get that big number.
So the second question is, since we didn't fund but 90% last year, where did you fall short? Where were the
well, the big issue
somewhere, right?
Yeah, so we scrimped and saved and made as tight a budget as we possibly could. you know, we've got, we're stockpiling PPE for potential reuse if we have to, for example, if we get such a budget shortfall. What I would like to point out is with COVID, a lot of the fundraising activities at the lake have gone way down. We can't do bingo. That was a huge, huge fundraiser. We couldn't do the golf tournament last year, which was a lot of fundraisers. So we made up the difference with a lot of those fundraisers, which are not available to us at this time.
I just had a crazy thought. I don't know if it's possible. Could you do bingo with Zoom?
Well,
in all seriousness, I hate to say that one.
No, I'm not sure how that would work.
I don't know how that would work.
We're suggesting doing bingo in the cars. And so we're actually going to look into that, seeing if that's a way we can do it.
Yeah.
Beep, beep, beep.
Yeah, the senior centers do it on the phone.
Do they?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'm just sitting here thinking to myself that if you could do the bingo over Zoom,
yeah.
You know, I don't know how you would collect then. The cards would be real easy.
Yeah. So we're starting to explore some things like that.
What do those two fundraisers, what's the amount of money that you typically collect on those two fundraisers?
The last couple of years, we've been getting between 60 and 80,000 from bingo and about 10 to 15 from the golf. So we're looking in the $80,000 to
$100,000
range.
That's not allocated
with the
law. No, but we don't have anything to do with their outside funder.
Yeah. I'm saying any adjustments based on the lack of their ability to raise those funds. We didn't make any adjustments for that.
No, because we don't. I mean, we see a budget, but we don't necessarily. We can't verify what they get or what they don't get. You know, from county budgets, we can verify to the T. I mean, sure. if everyone wants to give us inside to all their financial statements, and then we go through and we do just like we do county budgets, we could certainly do that.
But I'm just raising. I'm sure this isn't just specific to the lake. I'm sure all the other fire rescue departments have had similar fundraising challenges, and it's impacted them.
Yeah, it's just the one I'm most familiar with and can give you real numbers on.
Right. Well, that's far bigger than the rest of us. You do runs with stew and chicken barbecue. You don't make that much.
Yeah, you haven't done the runs with stew in a while.
We have not. Saw some pictures of that the other day, Mike. Well, can't do it now.
No.
Maybe after we get the vaccination. I don't know if you cook them enough. Alrighty. Thank y'all very much for everything that you do. Mm-hmm. You know,
thank you for your support.
And you are wrong. We did get $33. I say we is.
Yeah, and
that's something that we have discussed about trying to find another incentive to support the people that volunteer.
That's right.
I mean, it is a lot of time to give up.
Oh, yeah. And that is one of the things you'll see in here. I know that one of the we'll talk about at some point later is the. Volunteer incentive on the personal property tax. There is a line item for it. So we'll see about that. And the cancer policy as well.
Now, who pays for the training?
The squads.
Yeah,
so some of VDFP does some of the training.
You do it here.
So we do it yes.
We also,
the stuff we have to send in.
The county also has a pot of money for uniform training, just like kind of standard training that everyone can do throughout the county.
Some of the classes are paid for, aren't they, through
some of the classes are paid for.
County. Yes.
But also there's funds for EMT classes and things like that.
Correct.
In the county budget.
Yeah.
I thought the high school was going to have an EMT. Did they start one?
No, ma'am. They've not started that.
It's because it's felt.
They're trying to get it back, but they've not done firefighter one ever. And I will just say this much: my great nephew completed firefighter one. They had a big ceremony in Louisa because Louisa's teaching that.
Yeah.
And that's a way to get.
Oh, we just finished one.
Well, right, but I'm talking. This is a class in the school.
Oh, in the school.
Yeah. I mean, that was his class in the school was firefighter one, and I've been after him a lot. About getting those two things.
Yes.
If we want to continue to be all volunteer, that's how we get our feeder program going.
EMT,
I mean, and these guys do a great job with junior firefighters.
Mm-hmm.
I promote every one of them I can into getting involved. Volunteer your time. Give to others rather than worry about it. The only thing you get is what you get for you.
Right.
You know, that's what, well, anyway, I'll come to
100% right.
That's what's wrong with our country right now is there's too many people that are in the me generation and not worried about us, the whole picture.
Yeah.
Sorry. Get off my soapbox. Keep working at it, setting examples like these guys. I know if I drive by at 7 o'clock at night, I can probably pull through the Lake Monticello and knock on the door. I ain't gonna say nothing about who might be in there, but could start Super Mario.
Do you go in the schools a lot and do presentations?
Whenever we can.
SOLs is killing them.
Going back to Miss Mayo's, what do you call them, Terrific Tuesdays?
Terrific Tuesdays. Yeah, they come in. That would represent.
Yeah.
And teach
fire
safety.
Yeah.
Chief One's oldest child used to come in there all the time with him. Trayvon?
Trayvon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. and I mean, but it was nice for me to see people that I taught come in the fire trucks or things of that nature and teach the class, and the kids get excited about seeing these guys.
Right.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming in. Now we're just getting started. All right, folks, now we'll move forward with the action matters. I don't know if y'all want to sit here for this, if y'all want to go, y'all aren't going to hurt my feelings. Advertisement of the proposed FY22 real property tax rate increase. Ms. McGyver.
Good evening. Hopefully this will be quick. As you know, this is a reassessment year, and per state code, anytime we have a reassessment, we have to advertise a maximum real estate property tax for the upcoming fiscal year. It takes into account the equalized tax rate. So I'm just here to find out what y'all want to advertise as our highest tax rate, so I can submit the ad tomorrow morning to the review in order to meet the required deadline to advertise 30 days out from the public hearing.
And I'll pull up the budget so you can kind of see where we are. Sorry.
$2 now, that gives us lots of wiggle.
Makes it nice and easy.
We will get lots of public comments.
I like those round numbers, though.
No. We will ignore that comment.
So if the board remembers, let me see here, unhide.
Our equalized tax rate is 86.5.
86.5.
And Mr. Daw has proposed a tax rate of 89.5.
Yep.
And our current rate is?
Our current
92.5.
92.5.
92.5.
Yep. Right now in my budget, I've included, the 2% increase. You know, I've funded most budgets as most agree with my recommendation, my budget, which doesn't affect the tax rate but could affect the tax rate depending on what the board wants to do with CIP.
This is not locking us in. This is just
correct.
Saying we can't go any higher.
This is
92.5. Doesn't sound terrible to me to just say that that's the highest.
Yeah.
This is just the maximum rate. Are you okay if we use 92.5 cent? We can't go over 92.5?
Yeah.
I know you'd rather
come in. I think that's sort of deceiving then when you put that up, the public sees that.
Well, I know it's deceiving, sir, but this is a number that we got to come up with that we know we can't be below.
Mr. Weaver, one thing I can show you
if you're voting,
we can't be above it.
Yeah, right.
We can't be above that.
Right.
So we don't want to come in here and say we're going to use 89.5. Let's say we decided we want to go to 89.7.
Yeah. I know all about that.
Right. Just to address maybe Mr. Weaver, your concern, maybe it doesn't. You talk about deceiving. You know, this is the advertisement. It says what our reassessment was, and it gives a percentage. It shows what the equalized rate is. And then from there, based upon what the current rate is, if we went to 92.5, it's going to show what that percent increase is from the equalized tax rate. So, you know, it's going to show a substantial increase, and that's advertised in the Fluvanna Review for multiple weeks. And then it'll show what the total proposed budget increase is as well.
Michelle, your 89.5 is the proposed budget, correct?
Well, no. If you...
That's what you...
I would be more than what your proposed budget is, Mr. Dahl.
No, if you put in the proposed total budget increase, you'd be basing it on the 92.5, because that's what you're... If you're saying we want to advertise a rate of 92.5, you're going to show the six, whatever that percent works out to, the 6 cent increase from the 86.5.
Ms. Eagle, what were you saying, ma'am?
I was saying, why do we need to stay at 92.5? We know we're the highest in the area, except for Charlottesville. We're higher than Albemarle.
Well, this is not going to be our tax rate. This is just saying we can't go above this. I mean,
I understand that, but why don't we set that lower than 92.5?
I mean, we can go with 91.
Yeah, I think maybe it's the idea of, we're allowing the public to comment on how they feel about a budget. We're presenting, the maximum rate that they can be charged at, and the board is still in the process of making decisions. And rather than hamstringing us, one way or another, by being too low or being too high, we're able to make decisions, and we're able to get the public comment, so that we can validate whether those decisions are right or wrong. It's likely that we will be under 90 cents, but there's a lot of things that we can talk about between now and then. And we talk about the tax rate all the time, and we talk about, how people feel about it, but really for years we've had almost zero public comment.
No comment.
All right, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Dahl. Mm-hmm. If we were to do an administrative building, is that already added in? If we were to do the debt fund service?
No, that's probably the biggest discussion.
Right, so we don't have that in there, and he's at 89.5.
Yes.
So we're thinking about doing that building. We don't want to lock ourselves in.
Well, I mean, if you talk about any debt service.
I'm not trying to be.
You're right.
I'm not going up to 92.5. I'll tell you that right off hand. So.
It's not real.
If we go below that, we may not get the building.
I mean, you have three votes for 92.5.
Right? We're still discussing this, O'Brien. So if you go below that, we may not get the administrative building. Because we may tie our hands and not be able to do it. How much did you say it would be?
$660,000.
Well, that's the design. I mean,
that's the design. What I'm talking about is we went ahead and did the debt funding we were talking about.
We've talked about other financials.
Yeah, let's.
It's 3 cents.
Yes, but all right. Hang on, guys. Ms. Wisdale?
It's 3 cents if you put it in the tax rate. We did discuss paying the first couple of years out of fund.
Correct, but if we decided to pay it in the tax rate, it's 3 cents.
Which would be 92.5. Yes.
And that's, like I said, that's not saying that's where we're going to be. I don't think we've ever been close to what we said our highest rate was going to be.
Bear in mind, too, right now we have 300 in for the schools, and they're asking for 8.
Yep.
Ms. Eager?
Can you say that? We have what?
We have 300,000 assigned to the schools. They're asking for 800,000. So that would be another penny and three quarters.
Yeah. The biggest difference right now, kind of the biggest things outstanding right now, is compensation. We don't know, the schools, they've got some things pending for what the state's going to kind of recommend for compensation for schools. Same thing with county, social services, constitutional officers. So compensation's a big piece. Insurance is small. We know that we're still going to get hopefully some additional values back from the commissioner as time goes on. Their personal property, I don't think that's not come in yet, the final numbers. And we're going to get more property CO'd. And then just the biggest question mark is a lot of these CIP items. Did we want to do a big kind of, catch me up and take out debt because we've got really low interest rates? If so, we can fund it a couple of different ways. We can pay for the debt service payments for 2-3 years from fund balance until, over these next, as we looked here before.
We had I believe, $3 million is for CIP projects and cash funding.
Yes.
And that's what we talked about, possibly using that $3 million to go until we get to the 24 when the 1.2 comes off.
Yeah, over the next three fiscal years, we have $1.6 million falling off in debt service. And if you look back at, if we funded admin buildings, we funded catch up on, you know, some school buildings, on some fire and rescue apparatus, some county vehicles, that comes to about $1.5 million.
The other thing that we, you know, are good that we're doing some of it right now, but if you looked at our MRR amounts that we set aside each year in the budget, they're still woefully under what they should be. You know, they're just not meeting the true MRR costs. And so all that is a fancy way of saying that we are ultimately deferring those costs to a CIP budget that we're not funding properly to begin with. So, I mean, I think, you know, we have this discussion every year about what the tax rate should be, when the real discussion should be, what are the long-term needs of the county?
All
righty, so Ms. Eager, what would you want it to be?
You suggested what we had?
I just suggested that we put 92.5 as the cap. We can't go above that. We'll probably be below that. 99.9% sure we will be below that.
I don't know why you don't have the Commissioner of Revenue, extra revenue in here. Well, we're not discussing that.
He hasn't gotten any additional updates from him yet.
Those dates don't come, he doesn't get that until the end of
March. He said he's going to have quite a bit. I talked to him about it.
Yes, sir, he will.
He has not sent us any updates yet.
Ma'am?
He has not sent us any updates
yet. Well, so then we really don't know. We're just shooting in the dark. So.
But yeah, but
yes,
this...
Yes, sir. Exactly.
This is the process every year. We usually get, you know, the commissioner gets his personal property values in usually by the end of, right around this time, sometimes end of February, early March, and then as we go through March, additional homes continue to receive their certificate of occupancies. When they receive the COs, then he puts those against the taxable tax roll, and we can include those values into our budget. But at this point, he just doesn't have them yet.
Everybody does it different, but the original Commissioner of Revenue, we used to get that in early February and maybe in January. Now that was a projected revenue, what it was going to be. And if you underprojected, then it was carried over to the next year. You don't have to wait on it back the way they used to do it, but it's being done different now. So it's just a matter of how you want to do it.
I compare it to the census. Normally that census data comes out in April and we're not supposed to get it until September now.
Well, I'm ready to make a motion.
Well, I'm trying to get Ms. Eager, Mr. Weaver, do y'all have a price you want to set it?
Well, you had said you're from 86 to 89, you're going to look at that and maybe reduce that.
We're just talking about the advertised rate.
Yes.
This is just
what we're talking
about. Yes, sir. So, Ms. Eager, did you have something in mind?
Well, I suggested the 89.5.
Is that what you're saying, Mr. Weaver?
I'm saying that's be the advertiser rate.
Well, I don't think we can just lock it down at 89.5 as the advertiser rate. We're talking about doing the administrative bill.
Make a motion.
So, do we have to have a motion or just three people?
No, we need to have a motion because the board is voting on what staff needs to advertise.
All right, Mr. O'Brien, you want to make a motion?
I move the Board of Supervisors authorize staff to advertise the FY22 proposed real property tax rate for public hearing on April 14, 2021. The advertised proposed real property tax rate is 92 cents per 100 effective for calendar year 2021.
Do we have a second?
You're doing 92 and
not 92.
I'm accommodating.
I second.
Okay, we have a motion made by Mr. O'Brien, second by Ms. Booker. Ms. Eager?
I really want to say no.
You say whatever you want, ma'am. It doesn't matter.
Okay. Nay.
Yes, ma'am. Ms. Booker?
Yes.
Mr. Weaver?
No.
Mr. O'Brien?
Yes.
Chair votes aye. Motion passes 3-2. So the advertised rate, highest we can do it is 92, and we'll work our way down from there.
Correct.
Thank you.
All righty. We already done our closed meeting for the night.
Yeah, just one question to ask the board on here. So on March 10th, and I know we love having meetings, but on March 10th, we have the budget work session at 7 p.m. And so let me go back. March 3rd, we have a 4 p.m. regular meeting, and actually this is going to change because we have, and I'm probably going to kick myself right now, but we have a light regular agenda. So we were going to push on through from the regular meeting into the work session.
It's March 3rd you're talking about.
March 3rd, correct. So
are y'all okay if we just move straight into the work session?
Yeah, that's fine. Mr. Chair, we can't.
Yeah.
And this meeting, we can't talk about anything else. I want to talk about vaccines.
Yeah, let me just ask the board one more thing, and then I'll shut up.
I don't think we can do any of that tonight. I think we have to stick pretty much to the agenda. We don't. Mr. Payne's gone.
But you don't have new business on
no,
the old business.
No, ma'am. Because this is a work session. This is a work session. Yeah. Spoke,
I know
meeting.
It's a work session, but it's still.
I think she has the right to mention something.
Okay. I just mentioned it because.
Yeah, let
Mr. Dahl finish, and then you can make your public service announcement.
And the last item is for March 10th. If the board remembers, the board had agreed to let some chiefs from the state fire rescue association perform kind of a fleet overview. They met with all the chiefs of fire and rescue. And they've had a few meetings here. I think they are ready now to meet with the Board of Supervisors and kind of bring forward, you know, kind of what they saw and just some recommendations and things as we're discussing, fleet and CIP. We would propose to do maybe a 4 p.m. work session March 10th at 4 p.m. and then at 7, then break from 6 to 7 and then do the budget work session at 7 p.m.
So March 10th, you want a 4 and a 7.
Yep. If the board is open to that.
All right, I'm in.
I can't see. Ms. Eager, are you okay with that, Matt?
Yes. And is it the people who... Did the study going to be there?
Yes, they're planning on being here in person.
They're the presenters, correct? Or
yes.
The chiefs from
yes.
The chiefs and the men who did the study.
It's
the other chiefs.
The chiefs are the ones that did the study.
Okay, sure, I'm fine with it.
Okay. Oh, you've already got 3 yeses. So
okay.
This plan is that, gentlemen.
Yeah, and then, like I said, we'll certainly invite
sure
all the chiefs and everything. Yeah.
Going anywhere.
Yep.
So,
making sure you aren't going to be out of town.
Oh.
Maybe I will.
So I have nothing else, and I'll.
Yes, sir.
Public service announcement.
I know that you're probably working very hard on trying to get clinics here. The thing that bothers me is, of course, we do not have a county nurse. We have an RN right here that's going down to Virginia Beach and running 2 clinics. We need more clinics. I don't know what kind of control we have over it. There's been so much confusion. Today was so confused. It was supposed to be Saturday. They moved it to Wednesday. People weren't notified. And I don't know how many people here in Fluvanna that we have gone and have gotten the second one or the first one. I don't know how much, I guess Getty can push our emergency coordinator. How do we get our need to the right place?
You know, maybe it's something, something of the board reaching out, and whether it's a joint letter from the board or board members reaching out to the health director, Dr. Bonds.
Yes, she'll be on. She's coming on May 4th. She's going to be on a Zoom.
Yeah, and you know what? You know, and we too, like I said, we understand that, you know, there's different levels to who is responsible for what with the vaccines. You know, you got the federal level pushing out the vaccines. You have the state level with especially implementing the new registration system. And then you have the local health department that's, you know, kind of making this all happen. And there's certainly been a lot of growing pains with this occurring. You know, we've been told... But there's nothing in that's been for certain. We've been told that they were looking at doing some mobile vaccination clinics, going into those areas that maybe have a greater need. Whether it's, you know, going into Columbia, maybe it's going into Fort Union, maybe it's going into Kent Store. They had discussed that, and that's been discussed with us. But we don't have anything final at this point.
Yeah, because, you know, you can read about Albemarle, 400 and some out at Yancey School.
Yep.
Jefferson School, there have been 200, and they're pushing it out. And I know Albemarle got some kind of a grant to help with it. But it just...
I think we did about 400 today is what the number was.
I was number 329. It was an hour and a half after me.
We ought to have at least 400. Two on Wednesday and Friday. I know if the problem is probably getting enough people to do the vaccine.
I think it's probably more the vaccine, but that's probably
Shots. Yeah. We got more nurses in this county.
It's been slow. I know a lot of our folks have been going up and getting them at the Kmart parking lot. I hate to say that one.
Yeah,
so two of my coworkers went up every day.
Some of our people have a hard time getting over to the high school, but we can, if we know some's there, we will certainly get people there.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, Mrs. Booker, you know, I mean, you know, a lot of the first responders, fire and rescue, you know, some county staff, you know, we've and some of our elderly,
a lot of teachers and a lot of the
teachers older in our older population, but there is still a ton that needs to be done.
I've had two folks that are just across the line with some Louisians who got their shot today at Blue Mountain, but they were in the age bracket. Well, they're right across the line.
Yeah,
they
said rock. We can't go to Buckingham to get a shot. And
the CDC. Is that
what? Because they're Piedmont health department.
See, I don't.
They're different.
I don't think that's true. Because
yes, Kelly, it is. If you're a patient there, you will get your shot. There.
Now that might be the limiting factor.
Right. The governor has said
that you will not be turned away by going from district to district. But if it's a private health care provider that's doing it, that might be the limiting.
Yeah.
Trust me, we are
trying to push to get more done, and I wish we had more control over it. Yeah. It's just.
Can I tell you what I handed out in those folders? So that is all of the information that I will be presenting for the survey for next week. It will not come also in your packet. It will be in the electronic packet, but you've got what you're going to get for that. And
there's a lot of information.
There's a lot of information in there. And some of it I broke down by district, so you can actually see what's happening in your district. And then some of it is countywide. So if you have any questions, if you get really bored over the weekend and plow through that, and you have any questions, please email and let me know, and then I can address that in the meeting next week. But there's a...
This is
a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. And I have to appreciate it by reading it.
We'll skim it at least. I can't skim it. I'm reading it.
All righty. Do you have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Okay, we got a motion made by Ms. Booker, seconded by Mr. O'Brien. Ms. Eager?
Aye.
Ms. Booker?
Aye.
Mr. O'Brien? Aye. Chair votes aye. We are now adjourned.